One teenage boy plus one crazy town plus 3 weeks minus $40,000. That's the equation that adds up to the new novel, The Absolute Value of Mike by Catherine Erskine. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Catherine Erskine won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature in 2010 for her novel Mockingbird. She's in Iowa City today as part of a new festival that celebrates children's literature. It's called One Book, Two Book. I'll talk with her about her books and her career. Later in the hour, we'll find out about a program called Reach Out and Read. It helps to put books in the hands of children who need them, working through hospitals and doctor's offices. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Good morning. Today we're going to talk about books for young people. Later this hour, we'll find out about a program that works through hospitals and doctor's offices to put books in the hands of kids who need them. But first, a new festival is taking place in Iowa City this weekend. It's called One Book, Two Book. And Catherine Erskine is here today as the keynote speaker at the festival. She is the author of four books for young people, including Mockingbird, for which she won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature in 2010. Her latest book is called The Absolute Value of Mike. Catherine, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And it was quite a journey for you. Welcome to January in Iowa. Now that it's actually arrived for us, we've had beautiful
right.
weather until it was time for you to travel here. So I'm glad you survived it.
Thank you.
I want to start out by talking about Mockingbird, because although your early work was really well reviewed and widely read, Mockingbird is the book that really made you well known everywhere, not just in the United States, but I would guess also around the world. And it's a book with some very difficult subject matter. Could you read just the first few pages of the book for us to introduce us to it?
Sure. Chapter 1, Devon's Chest. It looks like a one-winged bird crouching in the corner of our living room, hurt, trying to fly every time the heat pump turns on with a click and a groan and blows cold air onto the sheet and lifts it up, and it flutters for just a moment and then falls down again, still, dead. Dad covered it with the gray sheet, so I can't see it, but I know it's there, and I can still draw it. I take my charcoal pencil and copy what I see. A grayish, squarish thing that's almost as tall as me, with only one wing. Underneath the sheet is Devon's Eagle Scout project. It's the chest Dad and Devon are making, so he'll be ready to teach other Boy Scouts how to build a chest. I feel all around the chest just to be sure his chest is underneath. It's cold and hard and stiff on the outside and cavernous on the inside. My dictionary says cavernous means filled with cavities or hollow areas. That's what's on the inside of Devon's chest, hollow areas. On the outside is the part that looks like the bird's broken wing because the sheet hangs off of it loosely. Under the sheet is a piece of wood that's going to be the door once Dad and Devon finish the chest. Except now I don't know how they can, now that Devon is gone. The bird will be trying to fly but never getting anywhere. Just floating and falling, floating and falling. The gray of outside is inside. Inside the living room, inside the chest, inside me. It's so gray that turning on a lamp is too sharp and it hurts, so the lamps are off. But it's still too bright. It should be black inside, and that's what I want. So I put my head under the sofa cushion where the green plaid fabric smells like Dad's sweat and Devon's socks and my popcorn, and the cushion feels soft and heavy on my head, and I push deeper so my shoulders and chest can get under it too, and there's a weight on me that holds me down and keeps me from floating and falling like the bird.
And that's the voice of Caitlin, and Caitlin has just lost her brother, and he was killed in a school shooting. What gave you the inspiration to write a book for young people about a school shooting?
Well, it came after the terrible shooting events at Virginia Tech in 2007, which is not far from my home, and it really hit me hard and took me a while to process that and made me think, how hard it is to explain that kind of thing to our kids when we can't really explain it, and how hard it would be to explain it to a child with Asperger's who sees the world differently anyway. And I had been working on a novel about a girl with Asperger's, and I still was sort of formulating it and figuring out where I was going with it. And I realized that she had this older brother who told her how to do everything. And what would happen if she lost him and she were on her own and had to face the world without him? And so that's why I had that event happen. And I really started the book after the school shooting. So it's really the aftermath and the healing process and coming to terms with something like that, rather than the event itself, because I wanted younger kids to be able to read this and not be too frightened by it.
As you just mentioned, Caitlin has Asperger's syndrome. Why did you choose to have your narrator, the heroine of the story, have Asperger's syndrome?
Well, I guess the main reason is my daughter has Asperger's, and I saw how people reacted to her and her behavior, and it actually took us a while before we got the diagnosis, so we were confused, too, about how to really interact with her and why she said and did some of the things she did. And once we understood, then it was much easier to figure out how to communicate better with her. And I just thought if other people could see the world through her eyes, and kids in particular could get inside her head and see why she acts the way she does, then it wouldn't seem so weird or foreign. In fact, there's a lot of logic to the way that she thinks. She just doesn't have any of those filters that we all develop, especially by 10 or 11 like she is.
Well, and for people who aren't familiar with Asperger's syndrome, it is on the autism spectrum.
Right.
And it's on the high-functioning end of the autism spectrum. But how does it shape the world? I mean, and of course, it's different for everyone who has Asperger's syndrome. But for Caitlin, the character in the story, how does it shape how she sees the world?
Well, she's very literal. And so she doesn't understand nuances and phrases that the rest of us understand. She doesn't really understand why we have to say all these niceties that people say that seem kind of silly when you think about it. She's very honest because she's, you know, learned that you should be honest. So she doesn't understand the sort of white lies concept. Like if somebody gets your hair cut, you don't say, oh my gosh, that's really ugly. You try not to say things like that. So it ends up getting her in trouble or giving her difficulty making friends. And that's a big thing that her counselor at school is trying to help her with, to try integrate her into the school body and let her have some friends.
It also makes it difficult for her to understand the emotions
Correct.
Of others and her own emotions.
Yes, which is why, in a sense, it's easier to read a book like this about the terrible things that have gone on, because it's sort of like you're one step removed. There's less of the emotion, there's more analyzing what's going on. And of course, she does feel emotion. She gets upset and she might have a tantrum or a meltdown, but she can't really verbalize that. She doesn't really understand what it is so much exactly that's making her feel so bad. So it's a process of learning emotions and not thinking of an emotion as an enemy, but something that can help you learn and grow and connect to people.
Obviously, you drew on your experience, your very personal experience with Asperger's in creating this character. Did your daughter help you? Did you show her things and ask her if this seems right to you?
Well, I did at the end. Mostly, I did a lot of research and went to workshops and conferences about Asperger's and talked with other parents of kids with Asperger's and observed the kids. because I wanted it to be not really about her, but about just a sort of any kid with Asperger's. And like you said, every kid with Asperger's is different, just like every other kid is different. But I wanted to have some of those similarities in there, some of the traits that a lot of people with Asperger's tend to have. And I did, in the end, just before it went to press, ask her to read it just to get her final okay, or hope to get her okay.
How did that feel, giving it to her at that point?
Oh, I was very nervous about that because, of course, she was my most important critic. I didn't want to mess it up since I was sort of writing this for her and kids like her. And so I was biting my nails when I gave it to her, and she brought it back and just gave it to me wordlessly. And I said, "Well, so what did you think?" And she said, "Yep, that's pretty much it. What's for dinner?" So I knew that I must have nailed it, because she would have said all the things that were wrong with it if there had been things that stuck out as not authentic to her. So that was great.
Has she talked to you more about it since then?
Yes. She has wondered why I didn't dedicate the book to her. And I did explain that, you know, she might not – I didn't want to be that public about it. I wanted to keep her privacy in case she didn't want to be associated with it. But she does, I think, appreciate her Asperger's, which is a good thing, because there's a lot to appreciate about it. She likes being a little different. She likes seeing things differently and handling things differently than other people might. And it's actually very helpful having her in the family. She's great with a lot of things.
This book has touched the lives of a lot of adults, a lot of young people all over. What are you hearing from young people with Asperger's? Are you hearing from a lot of readers who say, thank you for finally creating a character that is kind of like me?
Yes. And that's been very rewarding. Kids who feel like somebody understands me now, and this is just kind of like what I'm like. And it's nice to see somebody out there who's like me. And I got the most heartwarming email recently from a girl who said that she felt confident after reading Mockingbird and Mike. She felt like it was okay to be a little bit different, not the conventional kid, and it gave her confidence to step out and try things that she hadn't before. And that's the beauty. That's what every author wants, is just reaching one kid like that. It makes it all worthwhile.
I'm talking to Catherine Erskine. She's the author of a number of books for young people, including Mockingbird, which won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature in 2010. Her latest book is The Absolute Value of Mike. We'll talk more about that in a moment. And she's in Iowa City as part of the One Book, Two Book Festival, taking place this whole weekend, today, tomorrow, and Sunday in Iowa City. She's the keynote speaker. You can find out more about the festival at onebooktwobook.org, or find a link on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about books for young people. In a little while, we're going to find out about a program called Reach Out and Read that works to get books into the hands of young people who may not have books in their home in any other way. We'll find out about that in a little while. But with me right now is Catherine Erskine. She is a novelist for young people. She's written four different novels, and Mockingbird was a novel that won her the National Book Award for Young People's Literature in 2010. We've been talking about that book. Her latest book is The Absolute Value of Mike, and I want to talk about that in just a moment. But first, Catherine, you have an unusual career trajectory for a very high-profile novelist of young adult books. First, you were an attorney.
Yes, so that's right.
How did you start writing for young people?
Well, I always loved writing, and so being an attorney seemed to be the natural path for that. I don't know why, but I didn't think of a lot of career paths when I was in college, and so I thought lawyer would be good, and I enjoyed it. But actually, once my mother passed away and she was still in her 60s, I thought, I better write now, because I was always going to wait till I retired till I wrote. But I really think you need to follow your passion when you find it. So I was determined to just go ahead and try make it work. So it was great. And there are actually quite a number of children's authors I know who started out as lawyers. I think we're all frustrated writers, and finally we've come into our own.
Well, and I suppose when you're growing up and you talk to people about what you want to be when you grow up, there's a certain amount of discouragement that comes about when you say, I want to grow up and be a writer.
It's yeah.
Like, oh, well, good for you.
Right.
But maybe you should pick some way to make money.
Exactly.
So do you think that there was a choosing of a practical path that led you in that direction?
Definitely. My sister and I were told, you know, you could go into business or be a doctor or a nurse or a teacher or a lawyer. And so out of those things, the lawyer appealed to me the most.
When you decided that you did want to follow your passion and write, how did you make the transition?
First, I worked part-time for a while as a lawyer, but that doesn't really work as a lawyer. You end up working full-time anyway. And then I just quit. And my kids were very young then, so I could stay home with the kids. And then during nap time or little breaks, I would try to do some writing. And then eventually when they were both in school all day, I had a lot more time to write. And that's when it really became a lot easier to get something done.
You seem to be drawn to some fairly dark subject matter. And The Absolute Value of Micah, we'll talk about it in a moment, is a very funny book. Although, again, here's a young man in a very difficult position. He's lost his mother. He lives with a father who, although clearly his father loves him, does not understand him, does not relate to him, and has a difficult time caring for him. Is this a reflection of the kinds of books that you read when you were a child?
Somewhat, but I think it's more that I really feel for kids at this age, you know, sort of 11 to 14-year-olds who are going through a lot of transitions in their lives. And a lot of kids live in situations that aren't wonderful. And if you have a perfect situation, that you're very lucky, and that's great. And hopefully these books will show you what it's like for other kids. But I think there are enough kids out there to whom these books will speak and give some comfort, perhaps. And that's what I'm trying to do, to show that you can get through. A lot of us had problems when we were young, and it seems overwhelming at that age. But once you grow up, things do get a lot better.
Well, I was thinking last night as I was reading the book, I was thinking about how many of the novels that really endure for young people have the main character is an orphan or abused or, you know, in one of these extreme situations. That seems to be something that really resonates with readers, even if it's not something that they've experienced in their own lives.
Right. I think we like to see our characters go through something tough so we sort of know how we might handle a tough situation ourselves. And it's also great to see that kind of grit and determination succeed.
Well, and I also was thinking about children in this stage, you know, the 11 to 14, they feel often this degree of alienation, even if they are in normal, quote, happy homes.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a tough time.
Mm-hmm. Could you read us just a little bit at the beginning of The Absolute Value of Mike?
Sure. Chapter 1 is called Parallel Lines, Lines in the Same Plane That Do Not Intersect. My cell phone rang just as I was about to crush the Emperor of Doom's trebuchet and save the villagers from certain annihilation. It was the ominous beats of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. Da-da-da-da. Yes, Dad, what is it? Could you come here, please? Why didn't he shout my name like a normal parent? I walked next door to the study and flicked the light switch on. He was pushing piles of schematic diagrams around his desk, sending dozens of small Snickers wrappers onto the floor. Dinner. I picked them up along with the chunks of chocolate that fell on the rug and shook my head. Dad was probably 50 pounds heavier than he should be, the giant genius. Dad, when Dr. McGovern said to reduce your fat intake, I don't think he meant reduce the size of your candy bars. I bet he was thinking more like salad. I don't eat salad. Dad's voice didn't match his frantic fingers flipping through the piles on his desk. "What are you looking for, anyway?" No answer. His gray head was stooped so low that the glasses he'd shoved on top of it were staring straight at me. "Glasses. Have you checked your head recently?" I asked. He blinked up at me, then up at his forehead. "Ah, it's actually my keys I seem to have misplaced." But I noticed he put his glasses on anyway. "Did you try your pocket?" He patted his left pants pocket, and I heard the familiar jangle. "Ah, thank you." He stood up and grabbed his jacket off the computer monitor. "Must run, teaching tonight. Seminar this summer, Romania." Dad had been teaching math for electrical engineers for so long, he spoke in isolated packets of energy, like he'd turned into electricity himself. I pinched my nose to do my robot voice. "Too much resistance. Please complete circuit. Thank you." Dad took a deep breath. "I will be in Romania for 6 weeks this summer, lecturing at the university there and working on my book." Romania? The first thing I thought was, hey, isn't that near Russia where Sasha was adopted from? Then the full effect of what Dad said hit me like an electrical charge. I stared at him. "Romania? You can't go away. I mean, by yourself. How are you going to survive? Dude, you can't even find your car keys without me." He blinked up at the ceiling. "Car keys won't be necessary. I won't be driving." "I won't be driving? Is that all he could say? But how about all the regular, everyday stuff?" He couldn't do anything for himself. Pay bills, make toast, find shoes that match. He stared at me for a second, which is about as long as he can hold a stare. "Room and board is provided." "Fine," I sputtered. "I'll take care of everything here, as usual." I crushed the Snickers wrappers in my fist. Dad cleared his throat. "My colleagues inform me that it's inappropriate to leave he squinted at the ceiling, 13-year-old home alone." 14, Dad. Do the math. You're the genius. Nevertheless, I believe the minimum age stated was 16. Wait a minute. If I couldn't stay by myself, that meant he was taking me with him. "Dad, we're going to Romania, a trip, just like Sasha and his parents." "Sweet! Why didn't you say..." "No unsupervised minors allowed." I felt the chunks of chocolate melting in my hand. I can take care of myself." Shoot, I'd been taking care of myself and him for years.
And that's how it begins. That's the absolute value of Mike by Catherine Erskine. And that starts an adventure for young Mike, who gets sent off to stay with a great aunt and great uncle in rural Pennsylvania. And Catherine, this is a very difficult book to summarize.
It is. It's very quirky and very unusual. And it's just a kid who's thrown in with quite a cast of characters and has to try and make sense of them and work on a major project that his dad actually thought was an engineering project that would help him with his math skills, and turns out to be nothing like that at all. But it is a project that kind of uses Mike's skills, which is organizing, marketing, taking care of people, the people skills that his dad doesn't have.
Well, and he's a young man who obviously is extremely bright and very capable, but because he has a learning disability in math, which is the thing that is most important to his father, he feels like he's stupid.
Exactly. And I wrote this because a lot of kids with learning disabilities do tend to feel like they're kind of dumb because they don't maybe get straight A's in school. And that's how we measure kids. Once they get out in the world, once they get a job, once they go off to college, they'll find their niche and they'll find the things that they really excel at way more than other people and realize their value. But as kids, they often don't see that out-of-the-box thinking and that creativity as a huge asset, which in life it really is.
Having been familiar with Mockingbird and then reading this book, it made me think about the emphasis that you put on Asperger's syndrome in the first book. And then in this book, if I were to do some armchair diagnosis, I would say that's a spectrum that Mike's father was on. Was that something that was in your mind?
Yes. Yeah, there definitely is an element of awkwardness and lack of emotion in his dad. And I did that partly just to differentiate him from Mike, who is really such a good connector with people. That's one of his real strong suits. It's something that his dad doesn't have and doesn't seem to appreciate.
Having been put in a position, having won the National Book Award, I'm sure that puts you in a place as a writer that is enviable, where you are really making a living as a writer, and this is something that you know you get to keep on doing. How does that change your process?
I try not to think about that or let it affect me. I try to just write the story that I want to write. I do feel, though, that it's a little bit of a pressure to make it the best book it can be and find any flaws in it. I guess I've always tried to do that, but I have a heightened awareness of that now.
You feel like more eyes are upon you or more...
Yes.
More people are reading and critiquing and thinking about it.
Sure, yeah.
And The Absolute Value of Mike is a very funny book, although obviously there are some very serious themes within the book. And as I mentioned earlier, he's a young man who lost his mother, so he lives alone with his father. He goes to live with this aunt and uncle in rural Pennsylvania, and they've just lost their only son. He was an adult, but still obviously a heartbreaking situation for them. But in thinking about the very heavy subject matter of Mockingbird, although there is definitely humor in that book as well, it's also completely and utterly heartbreaking. Did you need to write something lighter and more fun for yourself?
Yes. Yes. I do tend to go back and forth. If I'm doing a very serious, heavy book, then I need to write something that has a little more lightness and humor in it before I can go back to the real heavy subject.
How would you characterize your relationship with the characters in your books? If you think about Mike as a person, obviously he's someone that you created, but how do you interact with that character in your mind?
I kind of try and become my characters when I'm writing, and I just sort of let them speak. And in fact, if I get stuck, I interview my characters. I talk to them about why they're acting that way or why they've gotten stuck, why they don't like whatever's going on, where should we go next, which sounds very crazy. But it's really just a way of tapping your subconscious mind, because sometimes we – especially as a lawyer, get very analytical and try to figure out exactly what should be happening next. And sometimes you just have to let it flow, and eventually you get to that point and it all ends up making sense.
You're writing about characters that are in the same age range as your children. As a parent, do you ever find yourself conflicted about what you're doing to these young people in your books?
There's this terrible phrase in children's literature, to kill all the mothers, and we don't really mean that, but just to get rid of moms in particular who want to take care of things for their kids. We really want to stick the kids out there, give them a lot of problems, and then give them more problems and make them rise to the occasion and solve it somehow as an inspiration to kid readers. So I kind of like throwing stuff at my characters.
And your mother self doesn't get in the way there.
Occasionally, you have to realize that you have to step back. You made something a little too easy for your character. You really got to make it tough.
What's your next project?
I'm working on a couple of things right now, but the one that's pretty much done is called Facing Freedom, and it's set in rural Virginia in the early 70s, and it's kind of a mystery. And actually, in this one, the mom is there, the dad has died, so I flipped it. There's a mystery element, and also addresses racism at the time. So I hope it's going to speak to a lot of kids.
You have lived all over the world when you were growing up in Israel, South Africa, Scotland, Canada, in the United States as well. Will you be taking, in the future, do you envision taking your characters outside of the United States and maybe taking us all to Africa?
Yes, yes. I definitely want to do that. I have two novels. There's three novels. One of them is an adult novel I'm working on right now that do involve Canada. And I have one that I've started set in Scotland and one in Italy and even one in Australia, but I can't really work on that much until I actually go there because I don't feel like it's authentic unless I go and talk to the people and be there for a while. So.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot of adventures to look forward to. Catherine, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. This has been great.
I've been talking with Catherine Erskine. She's the author of four books for young people, including Mockingbird, which won the National Book Award in 2010. And her latest is The Absolute Value of Mike. She's in Iowa City today as part of the One Book, Two Book Festival. You can find out more on the web at onebooktwobook.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio, to find out more about the festival. In a moment, we're going to find out about a program called Reach Out and Read. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Not every child goes to the library or has books in their home, but nearly every child does go to the doctor's office, either a hospital or in a clinic. Reach Out and Read is a nonprofit group that uses that contact to get books into the hands of children and families all over the country and, of course, in Iowa. Molly Ullinger-Topp is program director for Reach Out and Read Iowa. Hello, Molly.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for having me today.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And tell me about the inspiration for this organization, not just in Iowa, but in general.
Well, I'll tell you, the inspiration started way back in 1989 in Boston, Massachusetts, which is where our national headquarters is. As a collaboration between doctors and early childhood educators as a way to intervene in the developmental problems of children growing up in poverty. So our founders basically shared the understanding that because more than 90% of brain development occurs by age five, early childhood is the most critical time to ensure success in school. And so what better place to do that but within the structure of the well-child visit? Between ages 6 months and 5 years, a child will see their pediatrician, their well-child provider, 10 times. Reach Out and Read has a three-part model that is the really crux of our program. The first and second part, I believe, really go hand in hand. During the well-child visit, at the very beginning, the provider, not the nurse, but the actual provider, will give the child a book. And then along with that anticipatory guidance to the parents, why is it important to read with your child? And use that book as a tool within their well-child visit in evaluating the child. They can use it as part of their checkoff. And then the third part is really making that book a regular tool they use all the time, reading with their child on a regular basis, ensuring that our programs have literacy-rich waiting rooms with books in them so parents can read with their children while they wait, although turnover is very quick, so we really want to ensure they take home that book and use it in their homes.
Why is there such a need for books in the home? Why is this? I guess a lot of us just take it for granted that if you have a child, the books seem to follow, but that's not the way it works for everyone.
It really isn't, and you know, you would think that would be the case, but really, Reach Out and Read, first of all, we have 14 peer-reviewed research studies that really show the effectiveness of Reach Out and Read in having that intervention with the well-child provider. You'll have to excuse me. I'm battling a little cold. So
I understand completely. I'm talking about the Reach Out and Read program in Iowa, which has expanded to 87 programs around the state and serves almost 53,000 children in the state of Iowa. My guest is Molly Ullinger-Topp. She's program director for Reach Out and Read, and she has a cold. Are you feeling a little bit better now,
Mom? I am.
Okay, good.
Believe me, I talk of a blue streak. My throat's not cooperating. Children from low-income families hear as many as 30 million fewer words than their more affluent peers before the age of three. The problem is really compounded by the fact that 61% of low-income children really don't have any books in their homes. And a child, a young child especially, part of their developmental process, as you know, I'm sure everybody that has children knows this, young children really like to chew on books. They're kind of rough on books. And we really believe in getting books in the hands of children very young, as infants. And so a child will see their provider seven times between 6 months and 2 years. And so it's really important to make sure that they have those tools to read with the children when they're at a very young age. And then, of course, we partner with libraries and really encourage folks to go to the libraries, to build programs with libraries at our clinics. But oftentimes young children are rough on books. And so going to the library and checking out a book for a baby might not work as well as an older child. So we really want to make sure they have those tools, because that often is the deterrent for families to be able to read with their children. Sure. And oftentimes they might not even know that they can read and should read with their infant.
Well, and when do you recommend that people start reading to their child?
Well, quite frankly, you know, before a child is born, right after they're born, our program starts at 6 months, simply because that's when a child basically can sit up and they're sturdy enough to really sit with you on your lap while you show them a book. So developmentally speaking, as early as you can, it really is incredible. Research shows that a child that is read to regularly will have a 6 month developmental gain compared to their peers that may not have that opportunity by age three. So it really can make a difference.
There are so many things that need to go on in a well child visit. When a baby goes to the doctor, of course, there's the conversation about nutrition. There's the conversation about development. There are the conversations about, you know, all of those physical developmental milestones, the language development, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Was there any kind of a resistance that you ran into in trying to get doctors involved in this program, saying, you know, we want to add something else to the important work that you're doing at these visits?
I would say the resistance probably has been very, very minimal. One of our incredible partners is actually the American Academy of Pediatrics. In fact, we're endorsed by them. And Reach Out and Really Read started as a grassroots organization. We are now in every state. We're international. Reach Out and Read does receive some funding, so we are actually on military bases throughout the U.S. and at some bases that are overseas. So as far as the resistance, there may be some here and there as we're starting programs, but it's more of an education issue, educating doctors about how they can use Reach Out and Read within their already existing well-child screening processes.
I'm talking to Molly Olinger-Topp. She's program director for Reach Out and Read in Iowa. It's a nationwide program, but in Iowa there are 87 Reach Out and Read programs. If you've had contact with this program, if you've been interacting with them either as someone who takes your children to the doctor, or if you are a physician who has been involved in this program, we'd love to hear your story. Give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. As the doctors are talking to the parents about the importance of reading, what are the messages that they're sharing?
Well, basically they're sharing how important it is to read to their child. And it doesn't have to be, you know, for an hour a day. I mean, 15 to 20 minutes can make a great impact. And also they're sharing with them that that book is a dialogic tool. That book can open up the world to a parent and child in talking to each other. So when they're reading a book, they might not just read the words on the pages, but they'll talk about colors and shapes and vocabulary, and then maybe just talk about other things. And it really opens up a dialogue for children to have that give and take with their care provider. And that is really important for children. One of the big things about Reach Out and Read is that it is a family, really a family literacy program, in that the children read with those people that care for them, that take care of them, and it builds a great relationship and excitement about reading with that child.
Where do the books come from?
So how our program works, that's a good question. We have incredible partners in several publishers, including Scholastic Books, and they're incredible. They've donated millions of books to Reach Out and Read program throughout the country. But also how our program works is that we initially fund programs at 100% with their books, but then after the first year, our coalition here in Iowa will fund about 25% of the books. The national program provides 25% of the books, and then each particular program is responsible for raising money or doing book drives to gather the remaining 50% of the books that support their programs. And we receive our books at incredible deep discounts because we buy them in bulk, thousands at a time. And so that's kind of where the books come from, at an average cost of about $2.75 a book. But quite frankly, we can get them much, much lower if we're buying them in bulk. So we have a really wonderful system for getting the books to our programs. And then our programs exist in clinics around the state of Iowa. So the infrastructure is there. It's not something we have to invest in. It's there. And we have about 600 volunteers throughout the state of Iowa in these clinics, from the front desk staff to the nurses to the support staff, administrators, providers, that organize the books, that make sure reports are done biannually to the Reach Out and Read, and also to make sure that training is done with new providers and ongoing. We have, which is really wonderful, this past year we rolled out an online CME training where providers will receive 1.25 CME credits for going through the Reach Out and Read online training. There's four modules, and I encourage all of the people within a clinic to do the training, not just the providers, because it's so important for everybody to know what the program is about and about the research and why it can be so effective if they do the Reach Out and Read model within their program.
If you've been involved in this program, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-780-9100. And we have Amy on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Charity. It's nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too. And you are a pediatrician who has been involved in this program for some time, right?
That's right. I've been doing Reach Out and Read in Iowa and also in Colorado. So I've been able to see kind of the success stories in a couple of different states and talk to some of the leaders in Reach Out and Read, and also just really see how it's been effective for helping families. So, yeah.
So when somebody comes into your office and you decide that you're going to interact with them and give them a book, what do you do, and how? Let's just start with that. And what do you do when they come in?
Well, Charity, we're very well trained in the Reach Out and Read model. It's important to start by bringing the book in the very first thing, and I like to give it to the child. So let's say the child is 6 to 9 months. I just walk in and greet the families and then hand the book to the child. And you can really use that book to, first of all, just really watch the child's expression, because the expression is usually just an expression of delight. And it's great to point that out to the family and say, hey, look at how much your child is enjoying this book. You can also use the book as a developmental screening tool to watch how the child interacts with the book to see if it's appropriate for their developmental stage. And so it's helpful in that way, too. But what's really the most gratifying is to watch the families respond as they see their child really enjoying the book and loving the book, and then to see them back again and again to hear their stories about how much their child enjoyed the book, how it's really opened up a world for them of reading that they didn't have. You know, in our clinic, we see a lot of Spanish-speaking families, and I think they, in particular, have less access to books in Spanish. And it's very, very helpful. The Reach Out and Read program does provide bilingual books, and that really is something that our Hispanic families enjoy, and the kids are really more exposed to reading and language in that way. So it's been very gratifying for both my English-speaking and Spanish-speaking families.
Is this something you do with every patient who comes in?
You know, we do this for every patient that comes for a well-child visit from ages 6 months to 5 years. And, yeah, so if they're 6 months, they come in for a visit, they get a book, they get another book at 9 months, they get a different book at 12 months, and then on and on up until through their 5 years. And so families really know about the program once they've been started in it, and they really appreciate it. And I have, you know, I follow up at every visit to see if they continue to read, and they really are, they really respond well. And I think that what a key important part of the program is to really talk to them about why it's helpful, not only to just encourage a love of books, but also the fact that exposing them to language really does prepare them better for school. And so we're, you know, we do see long-term positive effects with this. And it's really something that I think everybody can get behind and support. And it really does need a lot of support, not just in Iowa, but across the country, to encourage that early childhood brain development.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you so much, Jerry.
We've got just a couple of minutes left. I want to get to Norma, who's on the line in Des Moines. Hello, Norma.
Hi.
And what would you like to talk about?
Well, I've seen the books at my child's doctor's office, but what I wondered was when we used to go to WIC, there was never any program there, and I don't know that my child is five now, so maybe it has changed, but I wondered if WIC is a place that you guys keep books and use the program with, and if not, maybe if it would be a good place, since so many people who are at or near poverty or who've lost insurance maybe don't take their kids to all their well visits.
Oh, that's a great question, Norma. Molly?
You know, that's a wonderful question. With the Reach Out and Read program, we have an application process for clinics they go through, and it's a very simple process. And the biggest thing about it is that the programs have to be able, they do well child visits. And so we're constantly expanding and constantly learning about places where we can expand. And I will definitely check into that, but we really exist within the structure of the well child visits, regular well child visits. But that's a great idea. I mean, I will definitely check into it.
It sounds like an opportunity, yeah. not necessarily just for your organization, but for someone to get involved there. That makes a lot of sense. Norma, thank you so much for your call.
Can I add one more thing?
Sure.
Reach Out and Read does exist in almost every community health center in Iowa, and most of the residency programs within Iowa. So we really do try to target those children most in need. And at the community health centers, we really are reaching out to the children that can really benefit from this program, as well as, you know, other clinics around Iowa. And quite frankly, we believe that every child in Iowa could benefit from Reach Out and Read.
Bobby's on the line from Iowa City. We have just 1 minute left, Bobby, but I'd love to hear a little bit about your experience.
Oh, thank you so much. My experience, my husband and mine work at the Johnson County Food Bank Crisis Center. These are people that are in desperate need, and what we do is go to the Iowa City Public Library resale shop and buy kids' books for a quarter, or sometimes we can raid the free shelves. And all of the books that we read that we're done with, we take there, and we take kids' books there. And those kids are thrilled to get any kind of books. And these aren't kids that go to doctor's offices, as a rule.
Well, Bobby, thank you so much for calling. So here's someone doing it on their own. But Molly, we are out of time, but before I let you go...
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, sure.
I just want to say thank you for letting us know that information, but I do want to let people know that Reach Out and Read is not just a book giveaway. The biggest thing, and as Amy had talked about, is that anticipatory guidance from the provider, talking to parents about why it's important to read, is so important. And the books are important, too, but really having your doctor work with you in providing that book and reading to the child is so important as well.
Right. It really goes beyond just having the book in their hands. Thank you, Molly, so much for your time today.
For having me today.
Molly Olinger-Topp is Program Director for Reach Out and Read Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. Technical support from John Pemble in Des Moines. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by The River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Monday on Talk of Iowa, in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we'll visit with some of the recent inductees into the Iowa African American Hall of Fame. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR.